Hi, I'm VOA's Alexis Strope with your worldwide news update. U.S. President Joe Biden is urging Israel to be careful in how it responds to Iran's missile barrage. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Asked to feed back an Israeli attack on Iranian nuclear sites?
The answer is no.
Saying he and fellow G7 leaders who talked this morning amid fears the region will devolve into all-out war would rather see Israel mount a more proportional response. Iranian Ambassador Amir Saeed Iravani says the missile strikes were in self-defense after months of Israeli aggression and gave his own warning.
Iran is fully prepared to take further defensive measures.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Israel is pressing forward on two fronts. The Israeli military is pursuing a ground incursion into Lebanon against Hezbollah that left 8 Israeli soldiers dead Wednesday and conducting strikes in Gaza that killed dozens, including children. As Israel vowed to retaliate for Iran's ballistic missile attack a day earlier, the region braced for further escalation. Iran launched dozens of missiles into Israel on Tuesday night. It was another escalation in a tit-for-tat cycle that is pushing the Middle East closer to a regional war. Israel warned that the attack would have, quote, repercussions. U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirmed his commitment to supporting North Carolina on Wednesday during a meeting in an operational center in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the wake of destruction from a historic Hurricane Helene.
Today, I approve the request of Governor Cooper for the federal government to cover 100% of all the costs for debris removal, emergency protective measures, for 6 months.
Meanwhile, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris visited Augusta, Georgia on Wednesday to meet with victims and announce federal funds to cover local costs following the storm. This is VOA News. Prosecutors say Donald Trump laid the groundwork to try to overturn the 2020 election even before he lost, knowingly pushed false claims of voter fraud, and, quote, resorted to crimes in his failed bid to cling to power. A newly unsealed court filing lays out fresh details from the landmark criminal case against the former president. It argues that the former president is not entitled to immunity from prosecution. It was submitted by special counsel Jack Smith's team following a Supreme Court opinion that conferred broad immunity on former presidents and narrowed the scope of the prosecution. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed to move forward with a reset in relations at pace on Wednesday as they eye further cooperation on areas such as security and economic challenges. Starmer, whose Labour Party won an election in July, has said his government will not seek wholesale negotiation of the Brexit deal that took Britain out of the European Union in 2020.
There will be no return to freedom of movement, no return to the customs union, a return to the single market. But we will find constructive ways to work together and deliver for the British people.
Starmer and von der Leyen agreed to hold regular EU-UK leader summits, with the first set to take place in early 2025. Nigeria's Emergency Management Agency says 14 bodies have been recovered so far in central Niger state, where around 150 passengers are missing after a boat capsized late Tuesday. Authorities say the tragedy was caused by overloading the boat. Timothy Obizu reports from Abuja.
Zainab Suleiman is the Niger State Emergency Coordinator.
Right now there are 14 corpses that have been recovered, and there are still the local people, divers. They are still going about recovering. They are in the waters right now, and the boat was overloaded.
Boat accidents are not uncommon in Nigeria, where safety regulations on waterways, including load limits and the use of safety jackets, are poorly enforced and often ignored by locals. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The bodies of almost 24 young students and teachers who died in a bus fire in a suburb of Bangkok have been returned to central Thailand, where they began their ill-fated school field trip. Friends, relatives, and Buddhist monks waited past midnight for the last of several convoys carrying remains, as well as relatives who had to go to Bangkok to help with DNA identification of the severely burned victims. Thai police are investigating whether Tuesday's fire on the bus.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. At least 150 people are missing following a boat accident in Nigeria.
Right now, there are 14 corpses that have been recovered, and they are still the local people, divers. They are still going about recovering. They are in the waters right now, and the boat was overloaded.
Guinea-Conakry celebrates its 66th year of independence. Supporters of Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara want him to run again for a fourth term in 2025. Angola and the Democratic Republic of Congo sign an agreement to boost oil development. Zimbabwe's president threatens currency saboteurs.
Our current banking sector is on sounding footing. However, we note with concern the resurgence of parallel market activities driven by speculative tendencies.
And Ohio Democrats and Republicans hope that Tuesday night's vice presidential debate will boost voter turnout in November. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's Emergency Management Agency says 14 bodies have been recovered so far in central Niger State, where around 150 passengers are missing after a boat capsized late Tuesday. Authorities say the tragedy was caused by overloading the boat. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Niger State Emergency Agency says rescue workers are searching for more survivors along the River Niger where the accident happened. About 300 passengers on the boat from the Mundi community had attended a religious celebration in nearby Bajibo village Tuesday night when the boat capsized. Officials say about 150 passengers were rescued, but the rest are yet to be accounted for. Zainab Sulaiman is the Niger State Emergency Coordinator.
Right now, there are 14 corpses that have been recovered, and they are still the local people, divers. They are still going about recovering. They are in the waters right now, and the boat was overloaded, which is what we've been what has been happening to a lot of these boat mishaps. They overload the boats, and most of these boats are old. So with the weight of people, sometimes they even carry food stuff in bags. You see that the boat capsizes or it breaks into two.
Boat accidents are not uncommon in Nigeria, where safety regulations on waterways, including load limits and the use of safety jackets, are poorly enforced and often ignored by locals. Authorities also say locals often ignore warnings about late-night travels by water. But the latest accident raises concerns about government negligence. A Niger State official who didn't want to be named told VOA this.
As far as I'm concerned, there is no anyone that is even using life jacket in Niger State. They don't even know what life jacket is all about. So there's nobody that is sensitizing them on the use of life jackets. The state government itself ought to have, you know, procure all these life jackets and some other things. But there's none for now.
Sulaiman says stronger law enforcement is needed.
The regulatory authority should swing into action. They should start to, like, enforce these laws. If they need to send officers there at the boarding points, I think it will go a long way.
Climate change is also contributing to the challenge. Nigeria has been seeing rising water levels due to unprecedented rainfall and flooding. Last week, Nigeria's hydrological agency warned of rising rivers and the potential risk of flooding following the release of water from Cameroon's Lado Dam. Last month, more than 60 farmers died in northwest Zamfara State when their boat capsized. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Guinea-Conakry celebrated its 66th independence anniversary on Wednesday with a huge military parade under the supervision of military junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya. But in parts of the opposition strongholds on the outskirts of the capital, angry youths opposed to the celebration set up roadblocks in the streets with garbage, resulting in a scuffle with security forces. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
Many Guineans, including the opposition, says they are disappointed because Junta-leader Mamadi Doumbouya failed to dispel rumors about his candidacy in the forthcoming presidential elections. In his speech, Doumbouya acknowledged current economic hardships, but says efforts are being made to resolve them.
Les nombreuses perturbations liées aux difficultés économiques.
It says numerous world economic crises, among which is climate change, have severely affected the socio-economic progress of Guinea, hitting hard on vital sectors and impacting export revenues and investment capacity. It says despite the tricky situation, important achievements have been made with the help of the rural community, private sectors, and public services. Doumbouya did not mention the transition, with just a month left to return the country to civilian rule as he promised on the 31st of December. The opposition has described the speech as insignificant. Omar Touré is a member of the opposition. He says Doumbouya should have just kept quiet because he said absolutely nothing about the election.
Mamadi Doumbouya did not say what the public expected from him. We were waiting for him to lay to rest rumors concerning his possible candidacy in the next elections. We know his intention, but we are strongly waiting for him in December. All he said was mere nonsense.
Political analyst Aboukarim Sani says junta leader Doumbouya will gain the respect of the Guinean people if he abides by his promise to step down.
People are taking the gentleman by his words. If he is to do that, it means he has eaten his words. In this case, if he steers away from that and looking at the general interest of Guinean people, I think he may have more respect and more credibility than throwing that into the race.
Guinea, a former French colony, gained independence on the 2nd of October 1958. The 66th anniversary celebration was marred by violence in some opposition strongholds on the outskirts of Conakry. This comes after the junta leader failed to say in his speech whether he will remain in office. Several youths sustained bullet wounds in clashes with security forces. The tension has later died down after the angry youth were told by their leaders that the Independence Day celebration has nothing to do with junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
Supporters of Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara this week said they would back his bid for a fourth term in 2025. The 82-year-old Ouattara was re-elected in 2020 following a contested election. His opponents argue then that his third term bid was a violation of the Constitution. Reuters news agency reports that Ouattara has said that he would like to step down if his rivals, who also commit to withdraw from politics. Iriki Dai is an Ivorian and the executive secretary of the Committee of Action for Cote d'Ivoire, a U.S.-based political movement. He tells me that the so-called petition is an attempt by President Ouattara to flout the Constitution and maintain himself in power.
Where in the constitutional law and anything that regulates elections, it says that when the people want you to run, then you run. If the people want you to run and you are eligible based on the electoral law, the constitution, without violating, then we are fine. But remember that in 2020, Ouattara was no longer eligible, but yet in the same argument of the people wanting him to run after the chosen candidate, according to him, died, and there was no other choice, he ran. So what I think is that, you know what, it is the same tactics giving to use for one to maintain themselves in power, that's all.
Of course, the president will be, he's 82 years old now. He said that I think he would like to step down. At the same time, his rivals should commit that they will withdraw from the political process.
But it doesn't mean anything. That's why you are confused yourself in terms of understanding. Because, listen, his rival or opponent, referring to President Laurent Gbagbo, who is the only one alive now, there is, again, you know, no portion of the constitutional law that says that, you know, somebody will step down on condition of other people also stepping down or not running. You understand that, you know, with this kind of argument being put forth by Mr. Ouattara demonstrates, you know, his inability to abide by the rule. And it does demonstrate the inability of all of these leaders at this age. Because even when it comes to President Gbagbo, he did, during the time of his presidency, admit that, you know, after the age of 75, somebody should not be running. Today, he has passed that age, and he is also trying to be the flag bearer for his political party and battling to have his name on the electoral vote, which will clear the way for him to run as well. So it is the same gimmick. It is the same, you know, tactics, it's the same argument, which again show those leaders, you know, inability to play by the book and then offer the Ivorian people a free, fair, and legitimate, you know, electoral process.
Could it be that the ruling party does not have any viable candidate besides President Ouattara?
That may be the case, but, you know, it is not a reason to rig the election again, as I said. If you want to play by the book, you know, it is again, you know, in terms of succession, in terms of renewing the political class, if I can say it like that, it is the onus of each political party to prepare a line of succession, new leaders to take over. It is the one thing to be claiming every single day that, you know, we want younger generation, you know, to take over, but then when the opportunity comes, you don't give them that chance, using, you know, all these kind of arguments that, you know, you just put forth.
Iriki Dai is the Executive Secretary of the Committee of Action for Cote d'Ivoire, a U.S.-based political movement. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 3rd. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Wednesday said his government will deal with parallel market dealers of the country's gold-backed currency, which he said is causing economic instability. The currency plunged by 44% on the official market last Friday, the first time that since its introduction in April, causing panic buying. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mount Hamdan, where Mnangagwa gave a State of the Nation address.
In a speech to Parliament lasting about half an hour, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said the adoption of the new Zimbabwe currency in April was an important step towards stabilizing the domestic currency anchored by gold and other precious metal reserves. He said it was important to steady the economy and tame inflation.
Our current banking sector is on sounding footing with sufficient capital and liquidity buffers, while profitability, asset quality and liquidity metrics have also remained stable. However, we note with concern the resurgence of parallel market activities driven by speculative tendencies. Corrective measures are being instituted to protect all Zimbabweans from economic disruptions. Together, let us lay a solid foundation for economic prosperity, peaceful development, and freedom from undue external interference.
Kudzai Mutisi, an independent commentator, commended Mnangagwa for his measures planned for the currency, which lost 44% of its value on the official market on Friday, sliding from 14 to 25 against the US dollar and to about 50 on the parallel market. Mutisi said allowing willing buyer, willing seller of the currency would stabilize it. He, however, said promises to support the currency should not just be words, but a policy that should be put into practice.
If it is not done in practice, then we still have the same problems that we have for some time now, for months or several months, several weeks. You will have the exchange rate stagnant or at one position. Then it will explode somehow, because you cannot rig the markets. You cannot lie to the market. The market will always expose your lies. So it is a self-defeating move to lie that they are implementing a willing buyer, willing seller system and not implement it. So it is very important that after this announcement, the right thing is done.
Obed Masaraure, the president of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, says there is nothing from Mnangagwa's speech for his constituency. The teachers who have been eagerly waiting for the speech in light of the 44% plunge in their salaries on Friday, after the government had said the currency is gold-backed and would not lose value by such large margins.
We thought he was going to speak to the issue of corruption because we know how corruption is building the economy. We thought he was going to give sound economic interventions to say how are we going to create growth, how are we going to improve production. He was silent on that. We thought he was going to speak on compensation of workers because their salaries when his currency was devalued. He never spoke anything to that. It's very unfortunate that we had to hear all that. For him, it was because he's forced by the constitution, but he appeared like someone who was not in the mood to play his constitution.
After Mnangagwa's speech, Zimbabwe's Minister of Finance Mthuli Ncube told reporters that the government would review civil servants' salaries. That would be certainly sweet music to ears of Masara Ure and his constituency, government workers. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Mount Hamden, Zimbabwe.
Angola and the Democratic Republic of Congo have signed an agreement with new terms for the coal development of offshore Block 14, according to local media. Straddling the maritime border between Angola and the DRC, Block 14 boasts a production capacity of 3.29 million barrels of oil per year. The agreement was signed on Wednesday in Angola's capital, Luanda. For more on this deal, VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached political analyst David Monda.
It's a very big deal because we're looking at the potential to extract close to 3.5 million barrels of oil a year between both countries. I think it's significant because both countries can leverage their weight in the diplomatic circles to extract concessions from Eni, from Chevron, in terms of extracting the oil. But both countries can also pool their resources in terms of scaling the project and bringing the cost of that extraction down. The challenge will be whether this oil wealth will actually end up benefiting the people of Angola and the people of the DRC. I think that's a big question.
Talking of benefiting either country, DR Congo, despite its large mineral resources, has had the conflict in the east. But Angola is playing a very crucial role in the region these days, including mediating between Rwanda and DRC. Would that help the situation?
Those are two separate issues. In terms of Angola's mediation, I think that's important. Angola has, you know, borders the DRC. It has had a very difficult relationship with the DRC in the era of Mobutu because he supported the UNITA rebels for many years. But specifically in terms of this oil extraction, Angola really has to manage this oil wealth well because Angola is one of the countries most heavily indebted to the IMF on the continent and also to China. On the other side, you have the DRC, which in spite of its vast resources, is one of the poorest countries on the continent. And as we know from the east, the central government in Kinshasa is not in control of many parts of the country. So whereas this is an opportunity for both countries to increase their revenue, but both countries also have significant debt. And I must add that even though this oil wealth has been found, globally we've really been trying to move away from oil, right? This decarbonization of the global economy. I think that's also something both countries need to think about. As much as they extract this oil, they should also use some of those revenues to invest in cleaner forms of energy and in green technologies, which I think will help in terms of climate change and global warming.
What do you make of the oil cars, especially as far as DRC is concerned?
Yes, it is definitely a major problem. We know many countries like Nigeria, which suffer from the oil curse. And we know in the case of Nigeria, what ended up happening is when oil was found, then the government neglected other parts of the economy. And all these petrol dollars that were coming into Nigeria actually ended up increasing inflation. So I think that's something Angola and the DRC need to be very careful about.
David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. The Namibian government is welcoming back nearly 100 Botswana of Herero descent to their ancestral land, marking a significant movement in the ongoing process of restorative justice for the descendants of those who fled German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, during the 1904-1909 genocide. The Talio Angela reports from The Hague, Namibia.
John Kanji and other elders of his clan have gathered at the Dobe Border Post, a transit area for immigration between Botswana and Namibia. His role today is the lighting of the holy fire, where he calls upon the elders who have already departed the earthly realm to guide and protect them at this significant occasion, which marks the return of the descendants of the Ova Herero who fled their ancestral land more than 120 years ago.
That they were one by that time. But now we are heavy border, but there is a different. Those who are, this is a different country. Namibia is alone. That one, but our communication is there together, those countries. You understand what I'm saying?
Kanji explained to VOA how the formation of the nation state and the Berlin Conference separated the Ova Herero from each other, which could have been a good thing because the Ova Herero from Namibia had somewhere to flee during the 1904 to 1908 genocide, which decreased their population by an estimated 80%. Although Namibia was prepared to receive 98 returnees, only 50 crossed the border on Friday. Some are still waiting for the quarantine clearance for their livestock by authorities before they can cross the border. James Irikua is the governor of the region where the returnees were received and where some will be relocated.
They won't be settled in Oshodanchuba region, in Omahege region, and in Hartap region, because the government of the Republic of Namibia, in preparation to receiving you brothers and sisters, efforts were made at high level. Indoor reception area was created in GAM, measuring around 20 hectares.
The 20 hectares at GAM will be treated as a transit camp for returnees to adapt to life in Namibia before moving on to the commercial farms they have been allocated by the government. At the settlement in GAM, the returnees will be issued hospital cards, proper identification documents, and their children placed into Namibian schools. Officials have promised that potable water, sewage, and electricity will be available in GAM as soon as possible. For Vitalio Angula in Namibia, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
Both Democrats and Republicans in Ohio are hoping that Tuesday's vice presidential debate will motivate people to participate in the upcoming election. VOA's Kane Fairbaugh has more from Ohio.
Middletown is the hometown of U.S. Senator and vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, a place he described in his book, Hillbilly Elegy, and where some of his supporters watched his debate with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz.
We feel like J.D. is very genuine because we know him. Somebody who's an everyday person.
Joe Statzer is executive director of the Republican Party in Butler County, Ohio, which includes Middletown.
In 2016 and 2020, Butler County led Ohio in plurality of votes for Donald Trump. It's conservative.
Statzer was pleased to hear Vance address the concerns most on his mind.
Like the border, like the economy, those type of things, like the strike now that's going on the East Coast.
Well, certainly people are concerned about cost of living. That's always important, and their health care.
Kathy Winant, chair of the Butler County Democratic Party, says reproductive rights and concerns about immigration were also focal points of the large debate watch party she hosted at a coffee shop in downtown Middletown.
As soon as J.D. Vance dehumanized into human beings by calling them illegal aliens, it was a little frustrating to hear that kind of language.
I'm still concerned about immigration if Mr. J.D. Vance were to be the next vice president.
Jacob Payen is a member of the large Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio, about 60 kilometers from Middletown. Some in his community have been targeted since the presidential debate last month when Republican nominee Donald Trump falsely claimed they are stealing and eating people's pets. What Payen looked for from Governor Walz was reassurance.
I need to be reassured that I'm going to be safe while I'm here in America, because we come to America to look for safety, for peace, for love. We come to America for all of that.
Payen believes he got some of that assurance.
Tonight, Tim Walz appeared to be more of a calm guy in the debate. Mr. Vance was more on the defensive mode.
My mind is made up.
Isaac Adi came to the United States more than 20 years ago from Nigeria and is a voter in Butler County. Despite rhetoric targeting Haitians in Springfield, Adi supports Trump and Vance's stance on immigration.
I came into this country legally, and I expect that everybody that is coming to this country should play by the rule, which is come illegally.
Democrats and Republicans seem to agree that the vice presidential debate won't change the outcome of the November election.
But what it does do is it lets people know how important it is that we all participate and that we get out and we vote.
Joe Statzer says the choice for Republicans isn't who to vote for, but when.
Just whether to vote for J.D. In advance or wait till Election Day.
Early voting in Ohio starts October 8th. Dane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Middletown, Ohio.
And that's it for this Thursday, October 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barkley in Washington.